Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting Toby Walsh, Professor of AI at the University of New South Wales. He'll tell us more about the year 2062 when, experts agree, artificial intelligence will equal ours. Some of ours, anyway.
I was going to say, yours, certainly. Then we'll be discussing anxiety and the essay as we meet the author, Olivier Sujic, to hear more about her latest work, Exposure.
And with December now underway, we'll unwrap some of the cultural highlights of the season with Sam Pattinson.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be looking ahead to next week's news today. And we'll enjoy some great music too. That's all ahead here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Here we are again, Aug, and I must say, the sort of seasonal spirit, a bit of festive cheer, pervades Studio One here at Midori House, with the show taking place as it is, with the Monocle Christmas Market in full swing here in Marylebone in London.
Indeed, it's my first year here and I have to say I'm enjoying it.
And every year I can do my looks like rain, dear, joke.
Very good.
Let me ask you, Aug, is there a favourite Macellari sort of Christmas tradition? I know it's a bit previous. Anything that you particularly look forward to? Gathering around the old Joanna, giving a tune?
Nothing like that. We do go to Midnight Mass every now and then. I like traditions. I really like crackers, for example.
What is it about crackers that you so enjoy?
I just enjoy the hats. I like the jokes. I like the toys. I like the pop that they make, or the crack, when you open them up. What do you do?
I like all of that stuff. I like a nice walk on Christmas morning. I like a gathering around the old Joanna for a tune.
One of the traditions that I've come to love is the Christmas ghost story, and I'm excited to say that later on, as we get closer to Christmas, we'll be having an interview with an expert on Christmas ghost stories to look forward to.
So that is what's coming up on this programme, Monocle Weekly, in the weeks ahead. Let's find out, though, now what's coming up on the news agenda in the 7 days from now. Hark! Who's coming down the chimney? It's Fernando. There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright. Fernando! Ho, ho, ho! Let's not get ahead of ourselves. I'm sure you don't have any Christmas trails just yet. We're still a month away, give or take. 4 weeks, at least. What's coming up next week?
Well, the first one, I'm always interested, on the 6th of December, Time magazine will choose their person of the year. And I've been wondering, because I like to predict things, who is going to be the winner this year? Of course, in 2017, the winners were the silence breakers, all the women that denounced men on the Me Too movement. I have a feeling that the far right of populism will be the person of the year. I don't think they will choose a person. I think they will choose, again, something bigger, because they tend to do that as well. And again, Time likes to say that person of the year doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing to be a person of the year.
That'll be rather depressing, although given the themes that we cover every week, Fernando, I fear it could be an apposite choice for the year. What would you like to see if it's not what you think we're going to see?
Well, it's very difficult to say because for me, especially politically, it's been, you know, very much a kind of a tough year. Sorry to be so gloomy right at the beginning of the show.
Well, you've got a bit of sunshine as well as all this gloom to spread. What else is happening?
Well, a little bit of sunshine in some ways. Today, actually, CBS in the US, they will show the Victoria's Secret show. But the thing is, Victoria's Secret, they are not doing very well. They had to change their CEO. And again, because of the Me Too movement, some women are saying the Victoria's Secret doesn't represent them anymore. So I think the brand is not doing very well at all. I mean, a lot of people look forward to see the event because they usually bring, you know, very popular artists as well. And I'm very sad to say that Adriana Lima, one of the most famous models, and she's also Brazilian, it's going to be her last walk. But perhaps this is the beginning of the end. Maybe perhaps I'm exaggerating a little bit, or the brand will have to kind of change the way they promote women because, you know, people say it's not very realistic. And to be honest, the clothes are becoming quite repetitive and they're not even very nice in a way. But it's still a big event. Do you want sunshine? I'll give you sunshine.
Please, Fernando.
The last two stories are sunshine because I love the award season. It's my favorite time of the year. You know, I'm a big fan of the Oscars, all those awards. This week we have two nominations coming in. The Grammys on the 5th and the Golden Globes on the 6th. And a lot of people like to make fun of the Golden Globes, but I like to say they're very important. First of all, when the show goes on air in January, they're fun to watch because, you know, usually they're artists in their tables and they're drinking champagne. And usually you see a drunk you know, actor and actress on stage doing a funny joke. That you don't see that on the Oscars. I like the history behind of the Golden Globes. You know, basically it's about 90 members of the Hollywood foreign press, and they're so powerful. The Oscars, they have 7,000 members. But this 90 people, they choose all those nominees, and, you know, it's premiered again on Lifetime Television in the US. And it's quite interesting. A lot of people say, how do those people know more than anyone else? But I quite like that. And I've been reading who are the favorites. The favorite, actually, the film, which I've seen it. And again, it's one of my favorites. Sorry, I'm overusing the word the favorite here. But it was with Olivia Colman, and she plays Queen Anne. And again, I don't like period dramas, but this one is a magnificent piece of camp. Basically, it's a queen that in between of one servant and a good friend of theirs. There's so much intrigue, sex, and so many great things about this film.
I love period dramas. Dangerous Liaisons is one of my favourites.
Ah, excellent.
You've seen
one.
That one? Yeah. Also like the remake with Sarah Michelle Gellar. Olivia Colman, her star is ascending and ascending. It seems unstoppable.
Listen to her. Is it recording? Because I think she's going to get the best actress in the Oscars.
Putting it out there early.
Exactly, exactly. Big films with big box office numbers. I think some people are saying the Black Panther will get quite a lot of nominations. Perhaps Mary Poppins, the new one. A Quiet Place, A Star is Born. So it's not going to be the year of the indies. I think that it's the year of big Hollywood productions in the award season.
My favourite film this year was actually Mandy. I interviewed the director of it for The Weekly not long ago, which had an amazing soundtrack, very atmospheric. Maybe style over substance, some might say, but I thought the style was substantive enough to carry it. Really great. What next?
Well, next is the Grammy nominations, which is the biggest award for the music industry. And again, if you want predictions from me, I think it's going to be the year of Ariana Grande. If you like country music, I think Kacey Musgraves, she can surprise us with nominations for Best Album of the Year, Record of the Year as well. I think there'll be a lot of, it's been a very good year for female singers as well. Sunshine enough for you guys?
That was reasonably sunny. Thank you, Fernando. Always good to hear from you. You're putting your neck on the line there with some predictions. Always high-risk strategy, but I like the moxie.
Thank you, Fernando. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Toby Walsh talking about the rise of the machines.
Now, technophobes may scoff, but according to artificial intelligence professor Toby Walsh, the brave new world described in science fiction could be just around the corner.
His new book, 2062, The World That AI Made, explores the impact intelligent technology is likely to have on society, from the automation of the workforce through to the chilling implications of autonomous weapon systems. And he joins us now to tell us more. So, Toby, 2062, that's the year that artificial intelligence maybe might start to match human intelligence. How did you arrive at that point in time as day zero?
I surveyed 300 of my colleagues, and that was the average estimate that they expected that machines would be as capable as humans. Now, I should say there was a huge variation in their answers, and some of them said never. So, you know, if you took a strict arithmetical average, the average itself would have been never. But the median answer, 50% said before 2062, and 50% said after 2062, but you know, some of them said it was going to take 50, 100, even 200 years. I think the important thing to take away, I mean, it's not going to happen on 3 p.m. on June the 2nd, 2062. No one has any idea exactly when it's going to happen, but it's probably not going to take 1,000 years. Equally, it's not going to take 10 years. It's going to be somewhere like 50 or 100 years. That means it's almost certainly going to happen in our children's lifetime, and for those of us young enough, maybe even if we're lucky, in our lifetimes. And then, I mean, the spooky part about 2062 was that after I finished writing the book and I'd actually given it to the publisher and it was being printed, I was explaining to my daughter about what the book was. And I said, well, it's sort of the world you're going to inherit. And then I did the maths, and she would be exactly my age to the year in 2062. So I think I got a certain message from that.
And I imagine that's rather sobering a thought for a number of reasons, Toby. Can I just ask you one thing, though, about this idea? And I'm going to sort of crudely oversimplify here. You kick off the book by talking about some of the great achievements of humankind. And one thing that strikes me is you mentioned this, art and the sublime nature of art. Presumably, to the point you made about those colleagues of yours who said, look, this will never happen, we're not expecting artificial intelligence to be able to replicate instinctive, intuitive things, feelings, emotions, art, stuff that's pregnant with that kind of meaning. That presumably doesn't enter the frame of reference, does it? We know that machines can more accurately, replicate an existing work of art. But in terms of that creative process, we're not talking about that at all. We're not talking about the emotion.
We are talking about creativity. I mean, you can teach yourself to be a bit more creative, and there are lots of tricks you can do that you can read in books, and those are the sorts of tricks I imagine you can ultimately teach a computer to do. And we are starting to build machines that do things that when humans do them we take as creative, and very recently Sotheby's sold some AI generated art for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we'll only see more and more examples of that happening, but I don't think we'll actually care so much about the creativity of machines, because it won't speak about love and loss and mortality and those sorts of things that are very human, because machines won't have any of those things. So even if they do become creative, I don't think we'll care so much about machines creating things as much as we do about humans creating things. And then the second point of your question about emotions, well, of course, computers don't have any emotions, and they probably never will have emotions exactly like we have emotions, because, well, we know that emotions have a chemical basis, and machines don't have that chemical basis. So, but they will understand our emotions, and we might ultimately give them emotional states of their own, because they may be more engaging to deal with. So whether those fake emotions will ever become something similar to real emotions that we can engage with is an interesting question, and one that we'll discover in the next 50 or 100 years.
Toby, sorry to just jump in there. You said they'll understand our emotions. Again, you're probably bored of these sort of semantic arguments, but will they understand them, or will they identify them? And does it matter how we sort of talk about things like that?
Well, already computers can recognise the emotional state. They can see whether a sentence is happy or sad, and they will get more and more sophisticated in time. It's not clear, you know, whether they'll have real emotions or whether they'll just be faking it, and whether just faking it is going to be good enough. There aren't many AI movies that researchers like myself like, because most of them end very badly and they're very typically very dystopian. But the one that actually most of my colleagues like, and the one that I like, is Her. And that is all about our emotional engagement with machines and how we will start to form emotional attachments to machines, and they will come across to us as being quite emotional beings themselves.
Speaking of films and not liking a lot of AI films, you know, the first thing that I thought when I saw 2062, The World AI Made, as I'm sure many of our listeners will think, is of the kind of singularity as depicted in Terminator with Skynet or The Matrix. You touch on the singularity in this book, and I just wondered if you could kind of explain it a little bit, and explain maybe why you don't think it's a kind of a thing to be worried about.
Well, it's this very seductive idea that at some point we'll probably build machines that are so smart that they can redesign themselves. They'll be smart enough to redesign themselves. And then those redesigned machines will be smarter than the original machines. And so those new machines can then do the same thing again. And this might be some sort of tipping point, some sort of snowball effect. And then very quickly, the machines will become way, way smarter than us, and they will run away from us. Now, the sort of people who do believe in the singularity are mostly people who don't work in AI, haven't spent much time trying to build the very stupid machines that we have today. They're people like Nick Bostrom, who's a philosopher, or Ray Kurzweil, who's an inventor, but not really someone who's actually built much in the way of AI. And most of my colleagues who have tried to build machines that are intelligent have a healthy scepticism that we'll ever be able to build machines that can recursively improve themselves. We've never built anything like that in the past. And there are a number, I actually go through in the book a dozen reasons why it's not impossible. There's no laws of physics, I think, that would be violated, that we, as far as we can tell, by having machines that would be able to redesign themselves. But there are a dozen technical reasons I give to say, well, actually, it's more likely not to be able to happen than to happen. One of the good arguments, I think, is what's called the faster thinking dog, which is that if you could imagine your family dog, if you had some magic device, or some magic dial, you could make the dog think faster. You could, make it think twice as fast, or maybe four times as fast, or 10 times as fast. At the end of the day, it's probably going to still be a dog with its doggy thoughts. It's never going to compose music like Bach or Brahms, and it doesn't have language. It will just be, a faster thinking dog, and it will think about bones faster than it. There's a lot more to our intelligence than just thinking faster. A good colleague of mine, Peter Norvig, who's been in charge of research at Google for many years, put it nicely. He said, and he's probably about the smartest person I've ever met, and a pleasure to have a conversation with. And he said, he was thinking about the Middle East problem. He didn't know there was some new story on the radio about some latest problem in the Middle East, and he said he thought about it for a while, and he thought, well, I don't think even if I thought for months or years about this problem, I'd ever come up with an answer. And, so even if I could think faster, it's just one of these intractable problems. And it doesn't matter how smart you're going to be, you're not going to be able to come up with a better answer to that problem.
You mentioned those figures like Ray Kurzweil, who are kind of leading proponents of this idea that AI is going to one day pose the biggest threat to humanity of all the potential threats that exist to humanity. I just wanted to ask a bit about how you think, how your understanding and how your colleagues' understanding of this technology differs from theirs and from the layperson's, and a bit about what you mean when you talk about an artificial intelligence. Because I think for a lot of people, it is this conscious computer that, a HAL from 2001, A Space Odyssey, a computer that can talk and relate to a human being as though it is that. But I think, the impression I get is that, in fact, that kind of metric of intelligence, maybe you don't find that so helpful.
Well, I mean, the irony with someone like Ray is that he wants to live forever. And maybe we will discover, actually how to repair the body and how we can make humans live indefinitely. But I suspect it's probably just shortly after Ray's going to die. The sad irony to every time I see him again, he's looking distinctly older and older, and he's got a very, I don't know if you've seen the latest picture of him, he's got a very dodgy toupee now. But, he's going to be freezing himself cryogenically in the hope that he'll be able to be brought back at some point and be able to live as he would like for indefinitely. But to go to the interesting idea that maybe the machines will become conscious, that probably is the most open question in science that there is. I mean, we have so little understanding of what consciousness is, and yet it's so central to our existence. I mean, from the moment you woke up in the morning to the moment you pass out at night, you're conscious. It's not just that you're intelligent, you're aware of your intelligence. It's the thing that dominates our experience of being alive, and yet we don't know what it is. I mean, we think it's something that goes on in our brains, but that's about all we know. We don't know where it happens in our brains. We don't know what structure in our brain is the cause of consciousness. It might well be, as Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, has hypothesized, that it really is just a figment of our imagination. Our brains are very good at imagining things, and it was a very useful device for us to invent this feeling that we're conscious. But it really is actually nothing very physical in itself. So it's going to be very interesting, and if one reason I think that AI is such a fascinating science is that it may reflect back something on this idea and our understanding of what consciousness is in the next 100 years or so, and whether the machines that we build that are perhaps going to be as smart as us, and probably if they're smarter than us, even smarter than us, whether those machines have anything like consciousness or not. It may well be that they're very smart but completely unconscious, and as David Chalmers calls them, just zombie intelligence. The smartest thing you've ever met, but there's absolutely no sentience, no consciousness about that intelligence. Or it may be that they do in some way become consciousness. it's interesting to think how that would be. I mean, there's, as far as I can see, there will be three ways that happens. One is that we program them to be conscious, and we, you know, put some executive layer on the top of the program, and it's aware of its existence and how its actions impact upon the rest of the world. That's hard to imagine because we don't know what consciousness is, so it's hard to know how we can program something that we have so little understanding of. The second is that, well, maybe it just emerges. It's, when the machines get sufficiently complex, they become conscious. That's quite an attractive idea, and it certainly, consciousness seems to be connected to the complexity of the brain. Our dogs are slightly conscious. They have, you know, slightly less complex brains than us. Ants have, you know, very little in the way of consciousness as far as we can tell, and they have much less complex brains. So consciousness seems to be connected with the complexity of the brain, but we don't know if you could have a complex brain that isn't conscious or whether you'd have to have both at the same time. And then the third possible way is, well, maybe machines learn to be conscious because we learn to be more conscious. I mean, when we're born, we're not very conscious of our world and our, you know, there's that way, amazing moment that your child discovers that they've got toes and that they're their toes and they can wriggle them around. So we certainly become more aware of the world and we're more conscious of our surroundings. So maybe it's something that, like other things that we teach machines to do, they become more conscious of themselves.
Toby, I wanted to ask you about, there's a part in the book you talk a little bit about joining all these themes up and what it can mean in terms of human development. And you talk, maybe playfully, about this second renaissance and the notion that, you know, through the acceleration of AI, we will discover something more or rediscover our own humanity. And you make quite a compelling case there that, you know, we're already seeing this extra value placed on the human, whether it's an interaction, the human hand on a product and so on. I just wonder, I think that case is potent, but I just wonder, in a way, does some of the technology that people use now actually paradoxically not help in that drive? Because people talk about, oh, you know, people are locked in their smartphones, that there's a, not a redundancy, but a sort of a passivity about the way we use certainly computers, which actually takes people away from the human interaction, the human touch. Do you think that's something, is that just a hump that we need to get over? Or do you feel that process is inexorable, regardless of if there's setbacks along the way?
I think you've put your finger on a really important point, which is that the technology lets us end up in both those possible worlds. The world in which we've become seduced by the machines and it's all the dopamine hits and we become very machine-like and they actually take away a lot of our humanity. And that's, we do see some of that, and we are being troubled by some of that already in our dependency on our smartphones and the way that our crackberry demands our attention. But equally, we're seeing a pushback. And we're seeing how people are, you know, in lots of hipster culture is turning back away from that onto, you know, valuing disconnected time, valuing the quality of the time. And, you know, actually, I think one of the most important messages of the book is, well, it's about, you know, we get to make the choice. We can actually choose to use the technology in a way that will hurt our humanity in the way that we've seen some of that happening in the past. Or equally, we can use the technology to do all the mundane, repetitive, dull things in our lives, free up our time so that we can do all the really important things. And as I say in the book, you know, maybe this will be the opportunity for a second renaissance where we get to be, you know, highly creative and the machines can take the sweat. And we, as long as we share the benefits around adequately, it could be a moment of a great flowering of creativity. And, you know, I like to remind people that the end of their lives, no one ever says, you know, I wish I did more work. They all say, you know, I should have spent more time doing the important things in life, you know, with my family and making art and spending time in the community, all those sorts of things. And maybe the machines will free us up and give us the time to do that. And it may be a moment where society flowers and humanity flowers again.
Thanks, Toby. And 2062, The World That AI Made, is out now. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Well, with a digital future seemingly on the horizon, let's now have some music only a human could have made. Here is Terza with Go Now.
Don't raise up.
That was London's own Terza with Go Now from her new album Devotion.
From one writer to another now, as we hear from Olivia Sudjic. Her debut novel, Sympathy, came out last year to great critical acclaim. In fact, she even joined us here at Monocle 24 for a conversation with our own Georgina Godwin on Meet the Writers.
Olivia's new book, Exposure, marks a change in form for the writer, from fiction to personal essay, drawing on experiences ranging from the publication of her debut to loneliness in foreign cities. She explores how assumptions and double standards dog female writers.
I caught up with her earlier to find out more. Welcome back to Monocle 24, this time on the occasion of the publication of Exposure.
Thanks
which
for having
is
me.
Our pleasure. A new essay out on Peninsula Press. You were mentioning, just as we were kind of getting a cup of tea before starting, this started as a kind of crowdfunded project. How did you get drawn into it?
So I basically, a few years ago, walked into Burley Fisher Bookshop, which is on Kingsland Road in Haggerston, just as it was recently set up, and got talking with the very knowledgeable bookseller behind the counter about what I should buy. His name is Sam Fisher, and he is now my editor in this project. He has now set up Peninsula Press, but last year, when he first asked me to do an essay for it, the plan was to launch with a series of personal essays. So he'd asked if I would do one too. And that was going to help the Kickstarter. We'll promise to send you these sort of three or four essays if we get it off the ground. So that was incredibly freeing, because when I was writing it, I sort of had the sense that maybe no one will ever see this, which actually was something that I had when I wrote my first novel, and I think is actually quite a crucial part of being able to write without too much scrutiny and too much of the inner critic that says, oh my gosh, this is difficult second album territory. Also, I think it being a small press, it's been really great to work so closely with one editor. It really feels like a kind of intimate scale, which really helps, especially when dealing with intimate subjects, and you don't feel like there's this huge marketing department, most of whom you've never met, who are the midwives now to your book. And then also the timelines are so short compared to one of the monolithic publishing houses. The timeline was so short that talking about it now is really fresh in my mind, and I still feel very much a part of this work, and it's quite nice to talk about it. And there was very limited amount of time to get nervous in the lead up to publication, whereas with my first novel, I wrote it and then I edited it and then it came out basically 3 years on from starting the project, by which point I felt like a different person.
So. Right, and you talk about that kind of feeling of remove from the novel in the book. It seems like this idea that you're at the time of writing, maybe not writing it for an audience, that it's this super personal thing, and then that by the time it comes out, maybe you've become ready for people to see it.
I mean, I guess it's just very different being a first-time writer who is publishing for the first time versus someone who is aware in a much more concrete way what publication actually involves. I think that the kind of foreknowledge as preparation is a quite handy thing, because I thought that I was totally alone in feeling these huge, often crippling anxieties about why do I have this microphone and I feel so unworthy, and what, you know, what am I really trying to say, etc. And I just think that that is basically par for the course, and so I hope to normalize some of those feelings, as well as exploring perhaps how we could slightly shift some of it so that it's less scrutiny on female authors, etc.
It is a very personal essay, this, and you talk very candidly about anxiety and about managing it and about how it's been debilitating. And there's a bit at the beginning that kind of stood out to me, because you say, this isn't always how I feel. And I wondered if that was a part of a consciousness towards the audience later. I mean, how do you feel when you're writing this, thinking about your parents reading it? Are you worried about precluding their worry?
Well, I think what would my parents think is an inevitable part of basically anything I write. And with my first novel, it was the sex scenes. And then obviously, like, if there's any parents in the book, the natural assumption is that they're your parents when they couldn't be further from your parents. And then again, it's like a litmus test of some of the journalism I've done. And this essay, I didn't really tell them anything about it. I didn't actually send it to them to read. I kind of left it till it had gone past the point of no return. And I think now most people I am friends with or who know me well, I think probably will find it easier and easier to not associate me too much with what I'm writing the more books I write, because I think when you're in a one-to-one ratio with your first novel, it's very hard not to basically elide the two and think that if you know the person, that the book equals them. And obviously, yes, this is an explicitly personal, non-fictional essay as opposed to a fictional novel. But in a funny way, I did actually use some of the same types of techniques as I use when writing fiction, which is to say that obviously I am trying to make a point and trying to sift through my everyday life, which contains so many moments where I'm not anxious or when I'm not stressed out about the privacy of writing, etc. And I'm doing very different other mundane things. So what you're doing is you're collating all these moments together into an essay, which then my granny read it recently and she said, I had no idea you were this nervous. It never really occurred to me, and or anxious. And I think that in a way it's own fiction, because I'm sifting through my life to bring out these threads and to find examples that really illustrate what I'm talking about. I guess that speaks to the point I try and make in the book about people's assumption often that writing about the self in whatever form, essay or memoir, is often seen to lack strategy or craft or rigor, especially when it's women writing, as though it's like your diary and it kind of rolls off the tongue so easily. But I sort of didn't feel like that at all. In fact, it was quite a short but quite painful episode of writing over the summer of about 3 weeks to do this, because you just think, how can I almost reduce what is my all-encompassing daily life into something that makes sense in a very small, crystal-like way to somebody else? And again, this as a little pocket essay that fits in your bag or whatever, to reduce what is your kind of experience of anxiety to something that can take that form is obviously both a positive but also quite a difficult process.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that process. Is it something that, you know, at the end of it, did you have a kind of feeling of clarity?
There's a lot, actually, that was unexpectedly positive about writing it. Part of why it's called Exposure is that I was looking at writing this personal essay as a form of exposure therapy, which in CBT or cognitive behavioural therapy is you basically exposing yourself to what you fear in manageable doses or under supervision. So if you have a phobia of enclosed spaces or lifts, then you get into a lift with your therapist, or you build up to that point by looking at photographs of lifts, as boring as that sounds. But after time, you weaken the association between what it is that you fear and the experience, which actually doesn't often have any negative associations. It's harder, obviously, when what your anxieties manifest around something like being exposed to the public or abandonment or one of those kind of much more vague fears. But this book, as much as it's about other things too, was a kind of concrete way for me to expose myself to exactly what I feared. And it has, touch wood so far, been a very positive experience.
There was this interesting kickback against, I don't know if you saw, maybe a year or so ago, there was a New Yorker article.
Gia Tolentino, yes.
There was like the polemic against confessional literature.
Yeah, well, she said that the boom in personal essays is now over. And obviously, I really admire Gia Tolentino, and she is one who commissioned a lot of them when they first became incredibly popular, arguably more so in America than in the UK. I've reread that recently because I think the phrase or category of personal essay is hugely elastic. And the ones, let's say, that I think she's talking about in that New Yorker article is much more like, oh, I had a ball of cat hair in my vagina, or like I lost a tampon, or like the, or, you know, I had sex with my dad. Basically, she kind of identifies a category, which is you've probably never heard of the writer. This is likely their first time writing publicly. And she also talks about how it as a phenomenon really took off exactly at the moment when magazines and websites of that kind had their budgets drastically cut, but equally a huge new surge in demand for content. But that's not the same for me as the type of personal essay which is looking outwards. And obviously I begin this personal essay by saying this is the origin for this train of thought, and this is obviously not scientific fact, and I'm announcing the kind of narrative bias, if you like, of the author. And then I'm going from there to look at other writers, and anxiety is a kind of social disease or an epidemic much more broadly. So I think that type of personal essay, where you're basically acknowledging your source, is, I think, increasingly, to me anyway, valuable, because I think there is an increasing hunger for kind of longer form ways of absorbing what's otherwise a quite frenetic pace of information out there. Well, I would say that because I've written one of them. So
you mentioned that while writing this, you kind of did employ some of these fictional techniques. And I wanted to ask about how, kind of coming back to the essay, I guess you must have written quite a lot at university, how coming back to the essay as a form has informed your fiction writing.
Yeah, well, it's so, I mean, yes, I wrote a lot of often quite terrible essays at university. I went to a university where their model was you basically write 3 a week, which now doesn't even sound that much, but my friends at other universities were like in a rhythm of work where they might produce one every couple of weeks, and they would have really put a lot of effort and thought into it. But me sort of churning out 3 a week often meant it was very, I basically often read just to highlight instead of really to absorb, and I didn't therefore get a chance. I mean, I'm sure other people did, but I didn't really manage, I don't think, at least in the first year or two, to produce any essays that made me feel very proud. I think by the end that shifted, but I just felt like the format that suits me, which is, for example, why I'm not a journalist, or I do journalism, but that's not my job, is because I really like to sort of slowly live with these ideas and create over time, and then, you know, really kind of, I really liked moving slowly with these things. And so I think that the essays I wrote at university, not only were they quite bad, but also at universities in the UK anyway, we're very much taught to write from a very impersonal academic perspective, and that's slightly different, I think, in America even. I think that's why I had so much trouble when I then came to writing a novel with using I, even though it was a fictional character, because I had spent so much time at university trying to really bleach out any identifying markers. And, you know, I'm sure, again, that might be changing because identity politics wasn't such a thing, you know, in 2007 when I began university. But I remember very much even being surprised when reading things. I think is it Amartya Sen who uses she instead of he as his kind of straw man example of things, etc. And I just remember being like, I always sort of speak like the queen in my essays. I'm like, one could. And it was just very strange then moving towards fiction, not least because I felt like all of my essays at university doing an English degree had been about breaking down other people's books. So it was then very strange to be trying to create my own, because in fact, there's that good line about a critic, which is that they are the ones who come onto the battlefield after the battle is over and shoot the wounded, which is, I think, increasingly how I feel. But at the same time, I think criticism is such an important art form in itself, but it doesn't necessarily lead to you being able to write. You know, you spent a lot of time looking behind the curtain, so it doesn't necessarily lead to writing good novels. And so then when it came to writing this essay, and the requirement, pretty much the only bit of the brief that was specific from Peninsula Press was it needed to be personal. So then I really felt like I had no idea what I was doing, that none of those essays really had prepared me for it. So it was much more useful actually to look at other essays, which are not the types of work that I would have studied at university. So Teju Cole, Joan Didion, you know, there are so many examples. In fact, even James Baldwin and Notes of a Native Son, those types of essays, which are just elastic in the way that they can roam around rather than follow, you know, a very coherent framework and be very purposeful or strident. Because I didn't feel like I had a hill I wanted to die on with this, or a soapbox type idea. But it did actually, as I began writing, I started to feel angrier. In fact, there are some funny editorial notes on the first draft from Sam where he just says, "More anger!" exclamation mark, which I think is now my motto.
Finally, let's do put on the crinkly tinfoil hat for one sec. I wanted to just ask, because obviously social media kind of is this powerful presence in exposure, and I think also in sympathy as well. Do you think a book that talks about contemporary experience without describing social media can accurately represent contemporary experience.
Of course, I'm sure there are ways of accurately representing contemporary life without referring to social media exactly. I mean, so I remember when I was starting to write the novel Sympathy, and originally it was not set in the present. It was not contemporary at all, and obviously therefore social media had no part in it. It was a historical novel. And increasingly, as I was trying to write, the internet kept on pushing its way in, whether intrusive in terms of my attention span or actually me thinking about how readers don't really have the same attention span anymore, or Amazon is destroying novels, or actually fundamentally that a smartphone basically detonates any plot of any of your favourite classic novels. You know, if you think about Romeo and Juliet, if he could have just texted the plan. And obviously that sounds a bit facile, but I think it's kind of true that basically any story with a kind of plot that's linear, that moves towards a kind of quest or destination, it's very difficult when you have information all around you and when the ways that you connect with people are often intangible. And so I was very interested basically in the way the internet was my enemy, but in keeping my enemies close, and then it became the subject of the work in that way. So I don't think it's a condition of representing contemporary experience, but I certainly think that facing the challenge head on, I think a lot of people probably write about the past or even just the 80s so that they don't have to include long scenes of people staring down at a screen. But if there are ways that you can actually look at what that is, that kind of otherwise dead-looking moment, I find that a really interesting challenge for writing.
That was Olivia Sujic. Her latest book, Exposure, is out now on Peninsula Press. And if you'd like to hear more from her, why not look her up on our Meet the Writers back catalogue on monocle.com/radio. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Finally today, it's time to discuss, if not the elephant in the room, maybe the reindeer in the room, Christmas.
With December started and the Monocle Christmas Fair positively raging just beyond the walls of these studios, the festive season can be ignored no longer.
Here to join us for a look ahead to London's festive cultural highlights is the artist and writer Sian Pattenden. Sian, thank you very much for being with us on the programme. I'd like to get started by asking you about the sort of mania around Christmas. And I wonder, is it important to preserve some space away from the hullabaloo of the high street?
I think that is, as they call it, a no-brainer. There is a lot of shouty stuff if you go to any high street near you. But you'll also find that there's probably going to be a library quite nearby if you're in a city centre, and there's also going to be
I've heard they used to have them in the 80s when I was growing up.
Yeah, volunteers run them now. But there's always an art gallery. And even if it's a municipal city art gallery, you can go in and you suddenly find a treasure. I think, yes, you're talking about something about contemplation and quietness and study and something that takes you away from that. And, I mean, you would think that maybe Christmas coming around the corner, or the festive season, whatever we're supposed to call it, there would be a lot of big, big shows. But actually, there's loads of stuff, and there's also an amazing amount of smaller things, more interesting things. There's lots around, and you would be surprised at the bounty of what's out there, especially in London at the moment. Mm.
This is it. We're just up the road from Oxford Street, kind of sitting here on a grim, grisly Sunday,
yes,
when maybe lots of people are kind of parading up and down, and their best sort of visual stimulus is coming from the light display.
Mm.
You've kind of got some tips from around and about that maybe offer a little bit more than that.
Yes, and some of them will include places you can go after. So you can, I thought, you know, what about Hampstead? Not central London, it's not far away. It's got the Heath, it's got the High Street, this beautiful Gothic architecture as well in Hampstead, if you should just wonder. But there's a wonderful place called Burgh House, which has been there for over a century, and is host to a Hampstead Museum, which is quite interesting, but also has some wonderful exhibitions and doesn't shout about itself and doesn't scream about itself, but is a sort of world away from hectic high streets and a very London-y sort of thing. At the moment, they've got an exhibition which is great, which is called All That I Am Capable of Becoming, which is an exhibition of local women artists. And you would say local women artists, but it's Hampstead! So they're all really famous and really wonderful. And it also is an ongoing thing. They've thought about making it into something that, you know, the tendrils then extend. So there's opportunities there for you to be part of the fanzine, the magazine that they're going to produce after the show, what you think about the show, putting writing in, putting art in. So they're asking for people to contribute. And it's such a beautiful area. It's in a beautiful house. It has something called a buttery. And things aren't called a buttery anymore. Downstairs, we can get a cup of tea and a slice of cake. It's next to the Heath. It's a wonderful... It feels like being on holiday when you go there. So I thought that would be a good place to start. If I was going to do a Saturday morning, I'd start there.
Absolutely. Good shout.
Yes, it's a place that you can still get lost, where some places seem difficult to do that now without bumping into, you know, insert name of high street shop here. Mm. You can just sort of ramble and lose yourself.
And go for a dip if you're so inclined. We've got one here that I'm really excited
yes.
about. And I think this is cool because it's almost certainly going to be touring. It's arguably one of the great works of art of this century. I'm going to sound pretentious now, but I actually know all about it because it's prominently featured in a novel by Ben Lerner, The Clock by yeah. Christian Marclow, which has been installed in the tanks at the Tate Modern. And as I say, will surely be travelling further afield. What can you tell us about that?
Christian Marclow's The Clock is a real-time film which lasts for 24 hours, which features every few seconds the actual time that it is taken from a movie from the last 100 years. And it's a very, very simple idea. It's also a difficult idea to execute. You think, how much Final Cut Pro did he get to? How long did that take?
The rendering.
but I went to see it not really knowing what to expect. Oh, it's The Clock or something. I think it's sometimes good to just blunder in places without reading the reviews, without, you know, discussing it endlessly beforehand. They have row upon row of sofas, people sitting in the dark and just watching clip after clip after clip. And some of the clips are indeed about 2 or 3 seconds. Some will last to a small scene, and they range from, you know, quite schlocky 80s straight to video films to a bit of Eisenstein to something from the new wave. Most of it is in the English language, but there's still, you know, some French stuff around, there's some Asian cinema and things. And it is absolutely hypnotic and absolutely wonderful. And I spent over an hour in there. And I just wanted to spend longer and longer and longer. It's one of the things, you don't look at your phone, you don't think about anything else, you just gaze at the screen. What's interesting is there's no narrative apart from what the time is. Hmm. And it's also quite good because you know what the time is if you've got to get home for something as well. You know, it has that practical, you know, it serves as a clock. There are so many levels to it. I am going to plan an actual day out where I get there quite early because it does fill up. So what I realised that after me and my friend came out, there was quite a big queue and we fortunately got in there in the morning. Go in the morning, plan 2 or 3 hours and just sit. And that luxury of having the time, no pun intended, of just sitting somewhere and watching was wonderful.
Well, we're back to that. Great. That, the importance of that quiet, contemplative moment that you described a moment ago. When do you ever just sit and ruminate on, well, literally on the passage of time? Probably not very often.
No, even when you have, you know, you get your meditating app that you don't use a month afterwards and, you know, have a go, you're still thinking, is it 10 minutes time? There's still the... Yeah, you don't get the chance to just go, right, enjoy it. Think about the time. Actually actively think about it. It's really good. As I say, I'd actually quite like to live in that room.
I was just thinking,
get much done.
How big a house would you need to actually purchase the work and install it in your house as an actual clock?
Well, I think they must be. They're going to sell the DVD or something, mustn't they? But you'd have to get it absolutely right. You'd have to get it so it was on the point where it was the right time. Because even if it's five or 10 seconds out, that would be quite disturbing. But maybe that's part of the artwork itself.
And what happens with daylight savings? It would absolutely wreak havoc.
Oh, it would, wouldn't
it?
Not just factored pause that it in. For an hour.
yeah.
They have
I've got an extra hour today.
24-hour screenings. But I think the last one was on December the 1st.
That's last night?
Yeah.
Okay, well, listen, there'll be other chances.
Yes, that's what I'm hoping. I want to sit there for 24 hours.
The importance of seeing this piece is...
it's wonderful.
That will endure. Let's move on. What about if people are in our neck of the woods? We're sat here in Marylebone, of course, and there's, you know, we're no strangers in the roads in the immediate vicinity to a few cultural happenings.
So yes.
One, quite literally, round the corner.
Round the corner, and it starts today. It's the... If people are aware of the term outsider art, folk art, naive art, call it many names. There is the wonderful Gallery of Everything, which is at number 4 Chiltern Street, London, and which, as I say, is 2 minutes away, which has a new show for Christmas and is fantastic. I just walked past them just now, still trying to open up because it's open tonight. And it has these fantastic tapestries from an artist from Belarus, and her name is Olga Franskevich. She creates these amazing tapestries, a lot of war scenes from her childhood. I think she's in her 80s now, but they are absolutely striking. The Museum of Everything and the Gallery of Everything are one and the same and have been showing outsider art for the last decade or so. They have many, you know, fans such as Nick Cave and Jarvis Cocker always go to the shows, things like that. But the person who curates it, James Brett, is fantastic at providing such a wealth of art that you would never see normally, that you would never see in any other sphere. It's not going to get shown at the Tate or the Royal Academy. There's something really heartening about it. I really like it. And I was quite excited to see it. It's literally in central London.
And James is a good friend of Monocle's. And he comes in from time to time to tell us more. There are those lay people who will say, I could do better than that. Mm. And actually, it's incredibly difficult to summon the clarity and the sort of, I don't know, the impact of a really effective piece of knife art or this sort of folk art. It's incredibly difficult. It's only the most capable artists that can do it, despite maybe in some ways appearances to the contrary.
It's about truth and about saying this is what I do and this is what I can do really well, whether it looks to you like a Rembrandt, whether it looks to you like a child's drawing. You always have to say when someone says, well, I could do that, you go, but you didn't.
That's always
it's the
answer,
doing
yeah.
is the bravery and the courage. But I would strongly recommend that, the Gallery of Everything. It's a great place.
Time is short, Sharon. What about a couple of other things? Something that's still running, I believe, at the Barbican, which you're a big fan of, which we should give a shout out to.
The fantastically named Wet Wang Slack by Francis Up Richard. It's fantastic. It's just catch it before it goes. It's at the Curve at the Barbican, and it's her sculptures, which are made from this Brazilian resin that she's the only artist who has it. And it's a sort of weird archaeological world. I don't want to give too much away, but she creates a world within that, and as I say, it's fantastically named after a Yorkshire place called Wet Wang. And I highly recommend that. It's really good fun.
And I guess at this time of year, you need to have a bit of fun as well. As well as all that contemplation and thoughtfulness and all the rest.
Yeah, you need to have a bit of fun. You need to go there and you need to just, loosen up, man.
That space is one of the best in London.
You should take that
on
board.
Isn't it nice? It's really good. Yeah.
Me?
Yeah.
I don't have fun.
No, you're probably too loose, actually. Wonderful stuff. Sharon, listen, it's an absolute delight. Thank you so much for coming
to see us.
I hope we'll catch up again, perhaps in the new year, and you can exchange some more cultural advisories for us.
Fabulous.
Be lovely to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Sharon Pattenden. And if you'd like to see some of Sharon's own cultural endeavours, head to raw-art.co.uk. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Well, what a show. The Christmas spirit positively coursing around in here, Org. I'm going to go out. I've got a rendezvous with some reindeer outside. Let's thank our friends behind the glass. As always, today's programme was produced by Tom Hall and Augustine Macellari, and researched by Fernando. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them all.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Augustine Macellari.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.